Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jairam.
And you're listening to The Coast.
To Coast.
Bio.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
Very, very fine. How are you?
I am doing quite well in rainy Seattle, and I believe you actually went physically to a synchrotron this week.
Yeah, actually, this was the last trip. I was almost getting nostalgic because we were like, oh my God, we don't have to do this anymore. But what's amazing was we'd gone to the Brookhaven National Labs in Long Island, New York. And we've been here many, many times over the last, you know, whatever, 8 years. The technology has improved so much. Like, even at this synchrotron, it's one of the older ones in the U.S. that, you know, when we started, I was doing three-minute exposures. This was when I did my graduate school project. Now, even as of 6 months back, we were doing three-second exposures, and that was a huge improvement. And yesterday, I was doing 0.2-second exposures.
Oh, wow.
And that's basically because of the, you know, just the optics and the physics and, you know, the undulators and stuff that they have now. But even 0.25 seconds compared to three seconds is such a big leap that we had almost a terabyte of data. You know, I keep talking about this, but it's incredible. I mean, it's almost like a movie at this point. You know, at 0.2 seconds, each snapshot of your crystal comes through so quickly that we went into the strip joking that we'll never need to go back. But at 0.2 seconds, it's worth a drive down there. Of course, they said they don't have money to get robots and stuff. But we are hoping. We are like, all right, you guys need to write to Obama and get some of the stimulus money. You know, we need to get robots here so that we can really, you know, use it even more and so on and so forth. But yeah, it was a good experience. And I think we might actually be going back to physical data collection if they don't get money to get the robots. But yeah, that's where I've been all weekend pretty much.
Oh, so the reason you can't do the NX stuff with Long Island is they don't have the robots which you can control remotely.
They don't have it on this particular beamline. Yeah, but
okay.
All said and done, yeah. It should be good if they do get the robots. Excellent. How have you been? What have you been traveling? Or
I wasn't traveling last week. I actually head out tomorrow morning to Sonoma for a workshop of the Genome Informatics Alliance, and yeah, it should be interesting. A bunch of sequencing companies, sequencing centers, infrastructure providers, all getting together to sort of figure out how to solve some problems, real problems with high throughput data, very large data, and so on.
Oh wow! So what is this? The Genome Informatics Alliance, you said?
Yeah, that's what it's called officially. It's, I think, something that's organized by Illumina. I don't know how public they are about it, so I won't say too much okay. Other than that. But yeah, it should be fun. I've never been to Sonoma before, so wine country. So it's going to be it's a very small gathering, just about 25, 30 people. So it's
very
going to
cool.
be 2 days of pretty fun discussion. And and I'm on the hook on Wednesday to give a talk. So yeah. We'll see how that goes.
Oh, wow. This is in your capacity as like Amazon?
Yeah, this is an Amazon thing.
Okay. Hey, so, I'm going to just move my mic a little so you might get some very loud sounds.
I might edit it out. Although I like sort of keeping all the quirks that we have. it sounds a little more human as opposed to a finely sanitized version.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's me next week. It's travel week, and it's been pretty busy. It's I think going to stay this way till like mid May. I think I'm pretty much swamped, and then maybe you'll see me at least once in the middle when I visit Boston for Bio-IT World.
So, awesome. Hey, we should do a extended coverage Bio-IT World because that's closer to home, I guess, both physically being in Boston, but in terms of what goes on there. That'll be nice. Yeah, we should try and do an episode while you're down here.
Yeah, let's try. It depends on my schedule, obviously, but I'll get all my equipment and we'll see how that goes. And moving on to the podcast itself, there was an important birthday last week on the 13th of March, Friday the 13th, literally, actually. And for those who do not know, which on our listening list is probably about maybe 5% of the people, I hope, was 20 years ago on March 13th, was when Tim Berners-Lee prepared the memo that, when he was working at CERN at the time, that ended up nearly a year and a half, 2 years later, in the World Wide Web, to the web of documents. And so it's great. I mean, the link I put up in Delicious was a link to Paul Miller's blog post, which he calls Happy Birthday, Web of Documents. Now bring on the Web of Data. Now, of course, I put it up for two reasons. One, I think, given our preferences and how the web has influenced us personally and professionally, it's a pretty important birthday. And I think the web has become such a part of our lives that it's a day that should be celebrated as with as much importance as many, many other discoveries out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the second reason I put it up was the second part of Paul's title, which was the Web of Data, which is something that obviously I've written about a lot over the last couple of years. And he and everybody else, I think, who talked about this birthday had a link to the recent TED conference where Tim Berners-Lee, whom I happen to have met last year at BioIT World, gave a talk on linked data and as opposed to the semantic web. I mean, I think Tim Berners-Lee definitely prefers the term linked data now, which goes beyond some of the scientific academic nature of the semantic web. And it's a little short talk, but it's great. And I know you got a chance to listen to it earlier today, and I wanted to sort of turn it over to you and think about, you know, how you think the web is important and where do you think linked data and the web of data and all fits into this whole thing.
I think, yeah, actually, thanks for sending the link along. And this is a great TED talk, like almost all of them are. And it was very nice to hear it from, you know, Tim Berners-Lee himself on how this is clearly where we need to be going. You know, he says, you put all your documents up there, and that's all good, you know, you have hypertext and that's all good, but now we really start needing to build the links. And I guess he really talks about the Gapminder guy, right? What's his name?
Hans Rosling.
And he says, you know, Hans Rosling gave this amazing talk about how he was mining data from United Nations and so on and so forth to get very powerful social contextual information. And the great part of the talk was when he had everybody in the audience recite, give me your raw data now. You know, it's all fine when you have, you know, a web page with hypertext links and all that, but even more powerful than that is the raw data, and the raw data that people can build links into and out of, and which is even more possible when you have access to, you know, like he talked about DBpedia or something, right? Which is like the Wikipedia, but in the form of a giant database, which is
but it's Wikipedia with an RDF, and it's an RDF version.
RDF,
of Wikipedia.
Okay, and it's also, you know, I don't know. I had the one cool part about the talk was when he talks of the obvious kind of, you know, benefits that would come out of it, and they were all life science, bio, you know, bioinformatics-y kind of benefits, which is funny because, I mean, I don't know, I always thought the World Wide Web was something created by physicists, you know, and now it might just be that the biggest use cases for the next big, you know, linked data, raw data now kind of movement is going to be things like healthcare and, you know, I don't know, climate change maybe.
I think and some of these things make a lot of sense. I've always argued, I mean, and to some reason, the semantic web and all these technologies have been more popular in life science than in other places.
Yeah, exactly.
Partly because if you just take a look at everything, you have RNA linked to proteins, linked to pathways.
In fact,
pathways.
His talk talks about, yeah, you know, you have genome expression data, proteomics data, you know, you have like, you know, haplotype data, you have all this diversity of data.
And it's all linked to each other. And it's all multiple links.
It's
not like one.
It's useless.
I mean, I think the classic case or something like that, it speaks to two things. The importance of making the raw data available, making the data available in such a way that other people can access it and link to it. The semantic web, the dream of the semantic web at least, is that happens automatically because all of you have these RDF scrapers talking to each other. But as I think somebody posted something about a semantic database of chemical experiments or some molecular experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And basically all you need is one database of all the molecules associated with it, another database somewhere else on all the experiments that exist with various molecules, just a list of experiments, and they're represented in a form that allows the two databases to talk to each other for someone who wants to build an API or mashup tool that takes data from one API, takes data from another API, and brings it all together. You don't have to put everything in one place. And I think the key for this web of data, which is something I've been screaming about for 2 years now, is the distributed nature of it. What made the web successful was the lack of centralization.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think with data, we have too much centralization. Centralization helps because of physical reasons for getting stuff in and out of places. I mean, I think there's only so much bandwidth available to people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we will end up in a place where there is multiple sources of data. And I think the key is going to be making them available in such a way. And raw data, I think it's almost criminal, especially in the life sciences, not to make it available.
Right.
And I think the biologists have done a great job at it. We make all our raw data available now.
Right, you know,
as opposed to people in other, chemists, for example, don't make anything available.
Yeah, you guys are notorious.
Yeah, you guys.
And us.
Yeah, I think we are both chemists for historical reasons.
Did you catch Harold Varmus on Jon Stewart Daily Show?
No, I was too busy watching Jon Stewart.
Okay, anyway, we'll probably come back to this.
We can talk about it, right? I mean, going off on tangents is part of the show.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with what Tim Berners-Lee was talking about, but along the lines of scientists reaching out to people. I actually heard that, I do watch the Daily Show often, but I heard about the fact that Harold Varmus was on the Daily Show on the This Week in Virology podcast, the TWIV, which is a great podcast by Vincent Racaniello and others from Columbia.
Yeah.
And the moment they mentioned it, I actually went and caught the episode somewhere, actually on my TiVo. But the great thing about... So if you haven't watched Harold Varmus talking to Jon Stewart, definitely do so. I mean, Jon Stewart's... I think he's... Of course, I like his show a lot. And the way he interviewed Harold Varmus, he really got it. I mean, that here was a scientist who had been in the bureaucracy in the past and is really good at connecting the two worlds. And, Varmus talked about several things, the last 8 years and, how science has suffered and about the whole Wall Street thing and so on. What struck me is he was trained as an English literature guy. And I never knew that. I always thought he was like an MD or a virologist. But, it was incredible. I mean, we were just talking about us being chemists and so on, right? I guess in the end, it really doesn't matter what you're trained as. Harold Varmus is now sitting on...
Eric Lander's a mathematician. I mean, he's not a biologist.
Exactly. Yes, it's just incredible. So. I mean, it's funny the number of English lit people you see even in software. There's quite a few Floss episodes that I've listened to that the guy who wrote PHP, for example, I forget his name. He was an English lit major in college, and I mean, Harold Varmus said, I had my beginnings in English literature.
I think it has a lot to do with the liberal arts education style that the US has, which is a very different system than everybody else on the planet.
Yeah.
It has its pluses and minuses. I mean, in our, it's not as razor focused as we tend to get in our neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Talking of Jon Stewart, and this is a complete digression. Everybody should see the episode where he pretty much takes Jim Cramer to the cleaners.
Actually, so I've been recommended to watch the entire week of March 1st through 9th in sequence because there's a build up, and I guess in the end he has Cramer on it.
Yeah. And it's fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's better. He's getting really good. I always thought that Colbert was a slightly more cerebral, but Jon Stewart's been pretty good lately. I haven't seen the Varmus thing. I'll have to go watch it.
Right. No, in fact, even The warmest thing is definitely a recommended viewing, only because of how well, you know, the two of them, like, you know, even Vincent Racaniello mentioned it, how comfortable Farmers was with, you know, being on The Daily Show, and how well, you know, I guess he was talking about his book, which talks about his years at the head of the NIH. And, you know, John Stewart says, you were like the, you know, the bouncer, you know, the guy who says that, all right, you know, I'm going to take 2 million away from HIV and put 2 million to like spinal cord injury, for example. And he's like, how do you do stuff like that? You know, and it was really nice to hear. And he said, you know, the stimulus is very important. It's definitely going to make a difference. You know, these are difficult times for us. And actually, the best part of the entire interview was when he said, we really need to fund basic science. I mean, to hear that from Harold Varmus, who's sitting on the presidential advisory board, was heartening. I mean, he said, if you look at genomics, if you look at, you know, the genome project, that came out of basic research in phage and microbiology.
Absolutely.
And he said, that is something we have forgotten in the last 8 years. He's like, we need to get back to it. I mean, he wasn't even making like political like statements like, oh, you know, the Bush years was something else. He was just saying, we've kind of diverted from going after much of fundamental science into other things. I mean, he wasn't casting judgments on it. It didn't seem like it, but he just said, you know, we have to remember that all of the good things that are happening now is because of fundamental research. And the way he put it was wonderful. So definitely watch the March 2nd episode of The Daily Show. And I guess we do have international people, but you can catch it on Racaniello's blog. And this, I'm sure, just Google for Harold Varmus, John Stewart.
And you can watch it on Hulu using the appropriate proxies that are there that make Hulu think you're coming from the U.S.
That's cool.
I forget what they're called, but you can find them if you're interested. It's not difficult. Staying off topic and staying on the topic you were just talking about, the basic fundamental science thing, it's actually amazing how people don't understand it. So Natalie Del Conte was actually talking about the Kepler spacecraft that's out there right now.
Natalie Del Conte?
She works for CNET. She has a video podcast. And she is now one of the co-hosts of Buzz Out Loud, which is one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh.
She replaced Molly Wood, who I really miss, because Molly has attitude.
Hey,
like anybody's business.
Just a second. Never mind.
Yeah, so Buzz Out Loud is a tech podcast. They talk about news. So there's three people plus guests, and they do a really good job. I think they're... It's probably one of my... It's a daily, and I really like... I listen to it every day. Anyway, so Natalie was complaining about the amount of money that had been spent on the Kepler space mission, given the economy, and when it could be given for mortgages and so on and so forth. First of all, somebody corrected her on the next episode and said, yeah, but this money was spent a long time ago for it to go out now. I mean, this is not... You don't suddenly get money to build a spacecraft. It's a commitment that was made 15 years back, right? Because that's how long it takes to plan such a mission. But the thing that people didn't point out, and I should have called in or written in and said so, is fundamental science cannot be measured in dollar terms. Basic science, and this is a point you were making, I think the point Harold Varmus was making, that being able to understand the very basics of why things are happening, you might not see immediate returns, but you can't look at it in those terms. You have to understand funding fundamental science is critical to things that might happen 30, 40, 50 years from now. But it's, as you know, it's important to our future in many, many ways. And it's also important to us just generally understanding things. So having so much science in the stimulus, I know there's people who are cribbing a lot about it, but I think if you think about the company in the long term, it's absolutely critical.
Yeah. And I think what another thing that Harold Varmus was talking about is how, you know, of course, he put it that the public obviously cannot be expected to understand the connection between, you know, a guy studying like phage biology and the genome project. And he said, you know, the onus is obviously on scientists to make that connection more apparent. And it was so nice to see him like get out there on something like The Daily Show and explain, you know, even for those 6 or 8 minutes he was on, And I think, yeah, we also have a responsibility, right, to make those connections more apparent and make it obvious, how some guy who's like studying, sediments and sediment formation in the Yucatan can have more an impact on climate change research than, some guy who's at the, I don't know, Department of what do you call energy or something. So yeah, I mean, yeah, no, he says, yeah, it is very it's good to see scientists who are so good at explaining, things and so good in the public eye and doing what we all should be doing is explaining why what we do is important to everybody else out there.
Yeah, I've almost always felt about, what would it take? And I think the problem I have with a lot of blogging in science, for example, is obviously people like me and you, for example, we are very niche audience. We don't write for the general public. But I think a lot of people who do still don't hit that because they get into too much dogma or too much criticism of policy. And I think you need storytellers. People who can tell stories but make them interesting. I mean, those are the kinds of books and that got us interested in science, and yeah, there's definitely space for that. So I'm looking. It'll be interesting to see how things evolve now that you have some. And I would love to see Harold out there talking about some of these things, and I'll definitely check out that show. And sort of getting back on track and talk getting on to linked data again. Now, obviously, I think the key part of that whole
Tim
thing for
Berners-Lee,
me
huh?
was Tim Berners-Lee talk was make that raw data available. We've talked
Yeah,
about it
exactly.
before
When
and
he made
before.
them chant, yeah, that was incredible.
And I think one of the interesting things that happened last week, actually it happened some time ago, but it was the public press release came out last week to coincide with Joey Ito, who heads up Creative Commons. His talk at ETEC is that the Creative Commons has finally made the CC zero. It's not a license, it's almost like a dedication public. They've basically made it available to everyone and taken it out of its quote unquote beta stance. So
So
what
wait,
so
I don't understand what's a dedication?
so in the public domain, when you say I'm putting this data in the public domain, you're not, it's not a license, right? There's nothing like a public domain license. You're dedicating your information. It's kind of works under copyright law. It has something to do with how you have to make it available. You can't just say this belongs to everybody. You have to dedicate it to the public, quote unquote. So in the US, there is something called the public domain dedication and certification. The Creative Commons licenses that they had address data remix and data reuse, but they never had something for this is just data that's available for the public to use
Okay, so this is the dedication part.
without any
Attribute.
attribution required, nothing. It's just
Oh,
available for the
okay.
public. And John Wilbanks has argued quite stringently, and I completely agree with him. And people have talked about, oh, should I make my data, raw data, available under a CC BY? He says, no, it should be available in the public domain. It's raw data. And so CC zero essentially completes that lineup. So I'll just read from what it is. It's a universal waiver that may be used by anyone wishing to permanently surrender the copyright and database rights they may have in a work, thereby placing it as nearly as possible into the public domain. So it's not a license, but a legal tool that improves on the dedication function of our existing US-centric public domain dedication and certification. So it's universal, may be used throughout the world for any kind of content without adaptation to account for laws in different jurisdictions. So it has the benefit of being expressed in three ways: legal code, a human-readable deed, and machine-readable code that allows works distributed under CC0 to be easily found. I think that's very, very important. What was even more interesting was that the first two data sets that they announced were the Proteome Commons Tranche, which is raw proteomics mass spec data, and George Church's Personal Genome Project, so the raw data from the Personal Genome Project. So these were the first two data sets that were made available under the CC0 waiver, as it's officially called. I think it's really important. I think people understand, I think the importance of Creative Commons in media cannot be underlooked, cannot, you can't overlook it. It's really important. And for us in the sciences and data providers and data creators to have the option of making data sets available as here it is, use it, no dedication required, nothing. And being able to label it with in multiple ways where you can go back and see this is exactly what it means. And sort of filling up the whole CC family while we are talking, while we are at it, is really important. And I was very happy to see that finally come to bear. I knew it was going to happen at some point of time. I knew Proteome Commons was involved. But it's cool. It's a good thing. And it fits in very well with giving us your raw data.
Yeah, exactly. I understand. So it's basically getting the whole dedication part to, but making it internationally applicable, kind of defining the public domain in a better way, right? Basically.
Yeah. So giving it a legal umbrella, framework, so to speak.
Cool.
Protecting it. Yeah, it's very important. So I was very excited to see that happen. It's interesting to see what the Creative Commons people are going to do in the sciences. I don't always agree with them, but it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. I mean, obviously, we know people there, Caitlin, and I met John a few times. So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses. CC0 actually fits in, and Creative Commons fits in well with an interestingly, flamingly, where I was involved, discussion on FriendFeed, which started off with the fact that the Creative Commons people had been working with Microsoft. And Bill Hooker, whom we all know and love, got really mad about it because Microsoft is evil. And that ensued in a discussion. But I disagreed.
Which goes into 40, 60 comments? Or more than that, maybe 80-odd comments, yeah.
Yeah, if you count the blog and friend feed and all that. So I'll give you my point and perspective on this.
So wait, let me get this. So this started off with a post, right? Bill Hooker said, right?
On it actually started off even further. So Glenn Moody is an open source, open data, open everything. His blog is called open... person. And Bill was really mad with the Creative Commons folks, with John Wilbanks, where he talked about that they were going to make an announcement in Microsoft where Microsoft will be releasing, under an open source license, Word plugins that will allow scientists to mark up their papers with scientific entities directly. So this feeds into some of the work that Science Commons has been doing. And it's very much built on semantic technologies. So what got Glenn upset was that Word is in his experience, because John said that Word is the dominant publishing system used in the life sciences and probably the place that most people prepare drafts.
Exactly.
And being, here's where the dogma part comes in. For Glenn, working in Microsoft under any circumstances, to do with open source, doesn't work. Actually, Bill was kind of not quite as militant about it. He first said that, scientists should be at the forefront of abandoning closed for open wherever possible, blah, blah, blah. And his response was that, but he did say that, the way he argued in favor of Creative Commons was by saying that scientists are selfish and they are under intense pressure upon which they have to function. So what it means is that it'll take them a stick to move it and so on. And I disagree with that. And I disagreed with that on FriendFeed. I think it's about being pragmatic.
Scientists are selfish, therefore they really prefer being in these closed environments, or
whatever helps them get their gets their grants done first and so on and so forth. What allows them to get their grants and
In short, we don't care, we just need to do our science and get on with it. It doesn't matter that Word is closed and so on, as long as we can get our papers written and published and get our grants funded, it's okay.
And the argument I made was it's nothing to do with scientists here. Word, for whatever reason, and the reasons are good and bad, is a dominant platform. If you want to get certain technologies like markup available,
you need to get it in the form that everybody uses. You have to start with
the place which everything uses. You cannot get stuck in dogma. I think it's unfair to call scientists selfish and conservative. Yes, they are, but I don't think this is why they are not using OpenOffice. OpenOffice just doesn't do it for them.
Exactly.
And I also made the argument that in a closed versus open argument, your open source alternative or whatever, not the non-incumbent, has to be that much better than the existing incumbent for people to make that move. Firefox being the best example, is that's what I used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people moved to Firefox because it was better than Explorer, not because exactly. people made you move.
Not in fact, because it was open or not, or whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, this I mean, it does matter. I mean, because, is... I mean, part of the reason Firefox works so well is because there's different people able to contribute code and mm-hmm. build plugins on top of it and so on. And it, all things being equal, the open source solution is better because you can improve on it in certain ways. I mean, Apache right. and MySQL are excellent examples.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no alternative to Word that allows people to be productive in the environments that they function in. And so I think it's more of a general argument is that I think it's unfair to call people scientists selfish in this case. I think there's more pragmatic things to be done. And Peter Murray Rust also had a blog post along very similar lines where he's talking about tools that he's developing in collaboration with Microsoft.
Microsoft. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, and for the same reasons. And yeah.
Right. So. No, and, you know, this whole pragmatic thing is very important because I don't think we even have the time and energy to, like, be fighting, you know, these battles because there's so much to do and so much to get done. You know, I don't care if somebody teams up with Microsoft and makes a plugin that allows me to annotate papers. You know, I absolutely agree. If that's the accepted publishing platform and you want to make a big change, there's nothing wrong in sleeping with the enemy and, you know, furthering one small cause in your own way. And I just think that things are changing so quickly now that a lot of, I mean, open source is no longer has the connotation, you know, that it did even maybe 3 years back, right? As you said, Firefox has changed that. You know, now, you know, everything that's out there that's big is starting to become open source and is starting off as open source. And unfortunately, Word still has its, you know, strong following. And it's okay to develop plugins for, you know, open source that make open science easier, even if it means doing it with Microsoft. I just think Microsoft gets beaten with too much, you know, like there's too much flack going its way when yeah. a lot of that is over and done with. I mean, nowadays, I won't be surprised if in another 2 years, you know, these are just non-issues because Microsoft is just on every standards, you know, organization because the rest of the world has gone so far ahead that it's these issues just kind of go away. But I agree. Scientists aren't selfish, you know. If anything, open source wouldn't have, you know, existed if it wasn't for scientists. I mean, it's not like enterprise that's been pushing open source, you know. I've been using what we talked about, you know, just about everything that came out, you know, like Python came out of a scientist, you know, he was at yeah. whatever, CERN. I mean, I was great.
Yeah,
on, you know.
And, yeah,
I mean, give me a break. I mean, you know, yeah. Even live scientists aren't selfish, you know, I mean,
we are protective of our data. I won't deny that.
Yeah, we are. Protective. Yeah, that's true.
But that's okay. We are conservative right. in some areas.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because there's inertia. We are paranoid about certain things because of the publish or perish system. And there's systemic reasons for that. But I think to say that we are selfish is just not right.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, he didn't mean to do the broad brush thing. And, but all said and done, I think it's perfectly okay, you know, to do things with Microsoft. What are you going to do? What if the Bill, you know, of course, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has nothing to do with Microsoft. But what say if Microsoft itself started funding research tomorrow?
They do actively.
No, in life science research, for example.
Yeah, they do. Research actively. You know, they fund a lot of groups.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so it's fine. I mean, I think John O'Dell makes a very good point. Of course, he works Microsoft now, but he made this
but
point.
But the fact that he makes some, you know, for me, the fact that somebody like John, who's all about openness,
right,
can work for Microsoft. Sam Ruby is likely to work for Microsoft. You know, it's a different world. I mean, they might have done a lot of wrong in the past, and I completely agree they have.
Yeah.
And they've been beaten up for it, sometimes very unfairly. But that's a different story. I think in general, let's say that if Microsoft would say that, you have to put these plugins in doc and you cannot make these plugins for anything else ever again, that's one thing. You don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I won't work with them. But if they're saying, hey, open source these plugins.
Yep.
Perfectly fine in my book. So anyway, so yeah, so that was my sort of one of our interesting threads of controversy on Friendfeed right. this week. We've gone on for about 35 minutes, and I know I've and you must be tired because you got back today, and you know I've got some work to do, so I'm gonna cut it short this week. But I would like to talk about links of the week, and do you have one?
Oh, go ahead, Atom. I'll let you get started.
Yeah, so my link of the week actually comes from an email that came from Mike Cariasso, who works for the Bayer team. But we know him under other ways as well. For example, he's the creator of Snippedia as well. And Mike sent me an email today about Prometheus. Prometheus is, I'll just read out the description. It's actually one of the coolest things out there. And it talks to the importance of having data available. So it's a tool to build a report based on Snippedia and a file of genotypes. Snippedia is basically a collection of genetic variation data in wiki form. So customers of testing services like 23andMe, DecodeMe, Navigenix can use Prometheus to learn more about their DNA. It can also pool the data from multiple testing services. And there's a new beta version of Prometheus available now, which actually takes advantage of some payments via Amazon, and it's improved performance. The runtime is now 5 minutes as opposed to 2 hours with the previous version. It has improved privacy controls. There's a Mac DMG file and a Windows EXE file, and so it's great. You can try using it. Compare me to you can do things like compare me to a Caucasian, Japanese, Chinese, African, things like that. It's the kind of tool that scientists should make more, and that's why I laud Mike for doing this. It's taking known public data with SNPs and everything. It's taking the fact that today we can get our genotypes from services and providing a tool that will allow you to play with it yourself. And I think it's a lot to do with educating ourselves. It has a lot to do with understanding genetics. So that's my link of the week. It's snippedia.com/index.php/Prometheus. The link will be in the show notes. So I'll just get it from there. So that's my link of the week, and the hats off on that to Mike Cariasso.
Awesome. Right. My link of the week is a little, I guess I've been looking at too much crystallography over the last 2 days. So it'll be crystallography centric. And it's actually a blog on Nature Network Boston. And, since most of what I do is crystallography, X-ray crystallography, this one, if you're not a crystallographer, you can tune out. it's the Reciprocal Space blog by Stephen Curry, who's, I guess, a crystallographer at the Imperial College London. But what's nice is he has his Nature Network blog and one other blog, which deal with a lot of, educating undergraduates and graduates in the skills behind crystallography. There's quite a few crystallography tutorials and so on sites out there, including some at bioscreencast.com, shameless plug. But what's good about Stephen Curry's blog is that he really is bringing, a new wave of blogging crystallographers, and it's really nice to see this. And he had some really good links to some movies that explained very good crystallography concepts and so on. So if you're even remotely interested in crystallography, check out the Reciprocal Space blog by Stephen Curry on Nature Network blog Boston. And I'll try and make my links more general next time. But this one's a crystallography geek thrill ride.
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to keep things specific, because I'm sure at some point of time we'll have blogs for Ruby developers which the rest of the world would not care two hoots about.
That's true.
Anyway, so that's it from my side. I guess we'll see each other next Sunday.
Hey, one thing. Should I talk about the Kindle?
Yeah, yeah.
The Kindle?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, this is awesome. So my wife actually got a Kindle, the Kindle 2, yesterday. And it is really cool. I mean, if anybody's thinking of getting one, I would really encourage you to go and check it out. It's a little expensive, But I do agree, it's a lot easier to be reading on it. I actually tried pushing a lot of my PDF papers to the Kindle just so I could like look at what it felt like. And it felt very natural, actually. I mean, some of the fonts didn't convert perfectly, but on the whole, like every time now, I'm going to soon start thinking of just pushing all papers to the Kindle,
You
you
know
know,
it's
and then read.
hers, not yours, right?
I actually, yeah, wait, she's asleep now, so I can say that. But it is a birthday present and all that, so, but that's okay. No, I'm kidding. But no, it is a good thing. And yeah, Atom. I mean, if Amazon gives you one, you can tell them you have a really good friend that who would like one too.
Okay. I would say too much because obviously I have conflicts of interest.
Yeah, you can keep your mouth shut, but hey,
No,
this is one
I
awesome
can't afford.
product.
I would definitely like to get my hands on one if I could afford it.
And yeah, the whole
So.
e-ink thing, it's pretty, it's everything worth the hype. I mean, it's a very good concept, and I can't wait for like I was checking out the Project Gutenberg and all of the open content out there, and I really think, I mean, it's a great way to be publishing content, you know, to be putting it in this e-reader friendly format as well, you know. So
So
it's a good thing.
the way I look at it is we will have all those things that you had in Star Trek, right? Where the captain would get his thing on essentially any one of these things. What the Kindle really needs over time is multi-touch. Once you've started working with an iPhone, you want to touch every screen.
I know that's true. Yeah, but
You want to flip you want to flip pages with a little flick of your finger.
yeah, I think that'll come probably in another 4 or 5 months. I wouldn't be surprised if they already have prototypes floating around there. So no, it's a good thing. Yeah, I never thought I would, you know, that I would. It sounded cool, but when I got it, I mean, I don't get things when they just come out. Just so everybody knows, this is a one-off thing. I was very excited at replacing paper that way, and it does come very close. Yeah, it's good.
Lovely, lovely.
Cool.
Well, so I guess this now I can say that we will see each other next. So we'll talk next Sunday. So cheerio.
All right. Yep. Bye.
Bye.